like your true crime like you like your coffee,
Red Handed is the podcast for you.
It's dark, intense, and might just keep you up all night.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti. And every week on Red Handed, we break down a different fascinating case.
From the most recent US trials everyone is obsessing over, like Brendan Banfield, Karen Reed, and Ellen Greenberg,
to the most unbelievable stories from around the world, there's nothing we love more than digging into every detail of the cases we cover, getting beyond a basic analysis and cutting to the heart of the story.
Red Handed has over 400 episodes ready to binge right now.
Plus, be sure to check out our weekly sister show, Shorthand, where we unpack everything from the Black Death to Area 51.
If you're looking for smart, detailed true crime with personality, check out Red Handed wherever you get your podcasts.
Spring is sprung and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save big.
Welcome back to On the Case, the podcast. I'm Paula Zahn, and thanks for joining us for Pod 32, Graduation to Murder. Tonight, we're on the case in Atlanta, Georgia. The cultural and economic hub of the Deep South became the setting for an unthinkable tragedy when an eighth grade honor student was savagely murdered on her walk to school. The details of the crime left the community shaken and put police on high alert. They feared that the evidence indicated it was just a matter of time before the killer struck again. June 7th, 1995. It was 9:20 on a beautiful, sunny Wednesday morning when a gut-wrenching call came in to the Atlanta Police Department. A security guard had heard two gunshots coming from a trail known to be used by kids on their way to school. When he walked into the woods to see what had happened, he stumbled upon a heartbreaking sight. The partially clothed body of a young girl sprawled out on the ground. Officer Reginald Boone was among the first responders to arrive at the scene.
They said it was a person down in the woods. It might need medical attention. I wanted to get there as quick as possible.
But just one look told Officer Boone that it was too late to save the young victim.
When I approached her body, she was twisted, laying on the ground. I touched her on the back of the neck, and she was deceased.
It was obvious that the victim had been shot.
I saw a wound on the side of her head.
Although he couldn't be certain, he believed the victim was a child.
I just knew she was a young girl. Couldn't really tell her age.
The bloodstained clothing scattered around the area left little doubt about the motive for the attack.
I immediately thought that she had been sexually assaulted. She didn't have anything on the lower half of her body.
The scene was something he hadn't been prepared for.
It was real shocking. I just couldn't believe that this had happened.
Detective Boone's heart sank as he pieced together the clues. He was certain the young girl had been killed while she was on her way to school.
All the students who lived in the apartment complex down the hill used to use this path as a shortcut to get to the school over on the other side.
It was gut-wrenching, and he couldn't help getting emotional over the senseless crime.
I live in this community. It was devastating to me. It happened on my watch. I was really saddened that this young person didn't have the right to walk to school and arrive there safely. She'll never get a chance to graduate, raise a family, and have kids. All those things were taken away from her.
But Officer Boone had to put his emotions aside and focus on the task at hand. While he sealed off the area, crime scene technicians collected two spent shell casings that provided investigators with a lead on the murder weapon. Detective A.B. Calhoun.
We didn't know the exact make, but we knew that it was a 9mm.
Then, just a few steps from those casings, Detective Boone discovered another critical clue.
About 10 feet from her body, I found a black purse and a backpack laying on the ground.
Inside the purse was an ID, which revealed the name of the young victim.
Her name was Nicole Smith. This young lady was a 14-year-old honor student at the middle school.
While police braced themselves to break that terrible news to Nicole's family, the teenager's mother, Aquanella Smith, sat in her apartment trying to make sense of the sounds of chaos she heard that morning.
I heard the gunshots. I could hear sirens and the helicopters and all the noise that was going on around that area.
Aquanella was troubled by the police activity, but she wasn't worried. She was certain her daughters Nicole and Akita were both safe.
I looked at the clock and I said to myself, it's not my kids because my kids are in school.
Then, just a short time later, she heard a knock on her front door and found out just how wrong she had been.
There was two officers standing there and they said, well, we found a body in the woods. And they said that we needed a picture of Nicole. And I got on my knees and I prayed and I prayed and I prayed. God knows I prayed. And I'll never forget. They looked at the picture and they nodded their heads that it was Nicole.
As Aquanella Smith tried to come to terms with her loss, her pain was magnified by just how special her daughter had been.
Loving, caring, at 14, real responsible. She was just a good kid.
She was wise beyond her years and incredibly intelligent.
She was an A student, excellent student. She taught me a lot of things. She was my walking dictionary.
She was passionate about education.
She tutored a lot of kids. She was just a smart kid and just cared about people's education.
Nicole was just a few days away from finishing eighth grade. And she had planned to go shopping after school that day for her graduation dress.
She was excited because I gave her my credit card. I said, well, you take my credit card today and you're going to find your white dress. And I'll meet you there after school, but you take the card in case I get there later.
Nicole was looking forward to graduating from middle school and joining her older sister, Nikita, on the high school majorette squad.
She made majorette. She made the team. She was excited going to high school with her sister.
Beyond high school, Nicole had big plans for her future.
She wanted to be a pediatrician. I know if she's still be here today, that's what she would be doing.
But now, all those dreams had been shattered. Aquanella replayed her final conversation with Nicole over and over again in her mind. It had been a lighthearted argument between mother and daughter.
What I said to her was, do not put your hair in a ponytail. You need to curl your hair. And she looked at me and she says, you crazy. Mom, you crazy. But I love you anyway.
Nicole put her hair in a bun and walked out the door with her sister. It was 8:40 a.m. The sisters met up with other friends and then started on their walk to school. The girls stopped at a store along the way and bought a soda and some candy. Just then, Nicole realized she had left important schoolwork at home.
She had left a project. So she told her sister, she said, well, I'll just go back home and get my project.
In order to avoid being late for school, Nicole took the shortcut through the woods. And it was on that trail that she crossed paths with her killer.
She was on the way back home when this tragedy occurred.
Police promised Aquanella that they would find the person responsible and bring him to justice.
I'll never forget the officer that came in the day that Nicole died, and I was lying in the bed, and he sat beside me. He says, Miss Smith, if this is the last thing I do, I'm going to find your daughter's killer. And I believed him.
But investigators quickly realized that it wasn't going to be easy. Police couldn't find any witnesses who had seen Nicole walking on the trail, nor the attack itself. Investigators turned to her autopsy report for a clue.
The medical examiner determined that she had been shot and she died as a result of those gunshot injuries.
It was clear that the fatal shot to her head had been fired at close range, leaving gunpowder residue on one of her hands. That discovery led police to a chilling conclusion.
She probably was putting her hand up in front of her face when the perpetrator shot her. I can't imagine the terror that she went through.
The medical examiner also determined that before Nicole was shot, she was the victim of a violent sexual assault. Biological evidence was collected and stored. Armed with those details, Officer Boone and his colleagues continued to canvass the area around the crime scene. He spoke with a maintenance man who provided a valuable lead. He said just after he heard the gunshots, a man came running out of the woods.
He saw a light-skinned black male carrying his T-shirt with a gun running.
The witness watched as the man tried to conceal his gun.
He was trying to stick it in his pants pocket.
The witness had limited details, but he did remember that the man was around 5'11 with a thin build. He thought he might be 20 to 25 years old. Investigators were able to create a composite sketch of the man the witness had seen. And they also began to ask themselves a troubling question.
What kind of person would do this to a young child?
The details of the crime convinced investigators that they were on the hunt for the most dangerous type of killer. One with no fear of being caught. Crime scene investigator Cheryl McCullum.
This case, to me, doesn't start at the time that Nicole is attacked. It starts hours before. That person chose to leave his house with a weapon loaded. This was not just a crime of opportunity. He was laying in wait. This person went there to harm whoever came on that path.
And only someone who knew school children used that path would have been waiting there.
He knew what time school started. Well, there's always somebody that's going to be running late. It could have been any child.
And that meant an armed sexual predator was on the loose, and no teenage girl in the area was safe. On the Case, the podcast, will continue in a moment.
If you like your true crime like you like your coffee,
Red Handed is the podcast for you.
It's dark, intense, and might just keep you up all night.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti. And every week on Red Handed, we break down a different fascinating case.
From the most recent US trials everyone is obsessing over, like Brendan Banfield, Karen Reed, and Ellen Greenberg,
to the most unbelievable stories from around the world, there's nothing we love more than digging into every detail of the cases we cover, getting beyond a basic analysis and cutting to the heart of the story.
Red Handed has over 400 episodes ready to binge right now.
Plus, be sure to check out our weekly sister show, Shorthand, where we unpack everything from the Black Death to Area 51.
If you're looking for smart, detailed true crime with personality, check out Red Handed wherever you get your podcasts.
Nicole's murder made front page news in Atlanta. The details brought out a wide range of emotions from the community. Detective Reginald Boone.
It was not just fear. People were really, really angry.
And the outrage continued to grow. Each day, the crime remained unsolved. Police knew it was a race against time and that every lead was critical. The case had generated a lot of publicity. After the word got out, tips started pouring in.
Oh my goodness, thousands. It was real intense.
But unfortunately, none of those leads went anywhere.
We'd always get these promising leads, and then they wouldn't work out.
Based on the location of the crime, investigators were convinced that Nicole's killer was from the area. Detective A.B. Calhoun.
Could this have been a disgruntled student that was maybe kicked out of school or someone that used to go to the school? There were volumes of yearbooks. I've never seen so many yearbooks.
But none of that hard work advanced the investigation. As the days turned into weeks, the case slowly ground to a halt. Then, 8 months after the murder, police got a big break. They received a call from a high school student with a disturbing story. He had seen a young man, who he only knew as Mike, menacing a teenage girl as they waited for a city bus.
The witness heard Mike tell a female that if she didn't shut up, that he was going to do the same thing to her that he did to Nicole Smith.
The witness also added another chilling detail. He said that Mike had a history of violence against young women.
Mike, he's been arrested for a sexual assault.
Detectives were intrigued, but without a last name, the lead was tough to follow up on. Police pulled the arrest files on every young man whose record matched the witness's description. They placed the most likely suspects into a photo lineup. Surprisingly, the work paid off. The witness was able to identify Mike.
You're thinking, wow, here it is. This is going to be the break that we need.
Detectives questioned Mike about the statement the witness had heard him make. They were stunned when he admitted threatening the girl at the bus stop. But he claimed he just wanted to frighten the teenager. He denied any role in Nicole's murder. But police knew there was an easy way to find out whether he was telling the truth.
We got a search warrant for his DNA.
Police collected a swab of Mike's DNA and compared it to the biological evidence collected at Nicole's autopsy.
Unfortunately, the DNA didn't match. It did not match.
It was a devastating setback. But even if investigators had wanted to give up, there was one person who refused to let that happen. Nicole's mother was relentless in her pursuit of justice.
I was determined to find this person. I kept reminding myself that Nicole believed in me. And I was not about to let her down.
Day after day, Aquanella worked her own unofficial investigation.
I had hope, and I was determined to find him. I didn't expect the Atlanta Police Department to find them because they was doing a job, and I was a mother. Wanted answers.
She hit the streets looking for her daughter's killer.
I would ask questions. Everybody was a suspect in my eyes.
Aquanella's determination struck a chord with everyone on the case.
I felt really bad for her. We needed to catch him. We just needed a break. Just one break.
Investigators hoped that the name of Nicole's killer might already be in the FBI's national database. Crime scene investigator Cheryl McCullum.
It was difficult for me to believe that he had not committed other crimes.
But CODIS didn't identify a suspect. The test results left police back at square one.
I just felt that there's no way that we can let this case go. Detective Townsley, the guy I started the case with, 2 months before he passed away, he called me up and asked me how it was going with this case. That's how important it was to people. That's how heartfelt it was to us to find the suspect and bring him to justice, because we needed to have justice for Nicole and her family. And that's what this all was about.
Detectives were frustrated, and a terrifying possibility loomed over the investigation. Was the killer in the area, and would he resurface in the worst imaginable way?
This is probably going to happen again.
More on The Case, the podcast, after this.
If you like your true crime like you like your coffee,
Red Handed is the podcast for you.
It's dark, intense, and might just keep you up all night.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti. And every week on Red Handed, we break down a different fascinating case.
From the most recent US trials everyone is obsessing over, like Brendan Banfield, Karen Reed, and Ellen Greenberg,
to the most unbelievable stories from around the world, there's nothing we love more than digging into every detail of the cases we cover, getting beyond a basic analysis and cutting to the heart of the story.
Red Handed has over 400 episodes ready to binge right now.
Plus, be sure to check out our weekly sister show, Shorthand, where we unpack everything from the Black Death to Area 51.
If you're looking for smart, detailed true crime with personality, check out Red Handed wherever you get your podcasts.
As the years begin to pass, the killer remained silent. Detective Reginald Boone.
I thought that the person might have gotten out of the area.
Still, the murder of Nicole Smith became a cautionary tale for the parents of every teenager in the area. They warned their children not to use the shortcut where she was killed. But over time, the case slowly slipped away from the headlines, and fear of a follow-up attack faded. That's why a then 13-year-old Betty Brown felt perfectly safe walking home from a friend's family barbecue at a park just 3 miles from where Nicole had been murdered. It had started to get late, so the two friends decided to walk home.
It had to be after 7.
Betty was just a few blocks from her home when she and her friend went their separate ways.
I left my friend at the red light. We said our goodbyes.
As Betty continued towards her house, there was no one else in sight.
And then out of nowhere, somebody just started approaching me. And he's like, "What are you doing out here? Why are you by yourself?" Questioning me as if he's concerned.
She had never seen the man before and felt a bit uncomfortable.
He kept making small talk. It wasn't alarming at first, but I'm still a little guarded.
Then, as Betty approached an empty lot filled with grass and brush, the man attacked her.
He just grabbed me. He had my mouth covered.
Betty was thrown to the ground.
He told me to be quiet or he would kill me. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, this is over. This is it.
The man demanded that she take off her clothes and then sexually assaulted her.
From the moment he grabbed me, I'm thinking, how am I going to get out of this? How can I fight him? My hands are in the dirt, in the grass, reaching, grabbing, trying to fight anything. I couldn't fight him off. I was so little.
Somehow, during that terrible trauma, the teenager found a way to focus her mind on critical details beyond just surviving.
I felt like if I was to get away, I want him caught. And I'm thinking to myself, how can you get him caught if you don't know what he looks like? So I'm looking at him and I'm studying him.
Then after what seemed like an eternity, the attack ended.
He just got up. Just got up and ran off. And once he did that, I got up. And as I was running home, I ran into a couple of my mom's friends.
The women understood that Betty had been the victim of a violent crime, but there was nothing they could do to comfort her.
I didn't want anybody to touch me. I didn't want to be held, but they managed to get me in the car and they drove me home.
As soon as she walked inside her home, Betty told her parents about the attack.
I told my mom. I said, "Mom, somebody just raped me." My dad, he just put me in the car and we went to the hospital.
During the exam, investigators recovered biological evidence. When the sample was uploaded into CODIS, police were stunned. The DNA was a match to Nicole Smith's killer. For Betty, the results raised a disturbing new question.
I was able to walk away. Why me?
It was a question that she's never been able to answer.
I was very shocked that I survived that. It was a lot to deal with.
She also couldn't comprehend how a routine walk home in a safe area had almost led to her death.
It wasn't far from my house. I didn't expect anything. My family stayed on almost every other street, so
it was something normal for me. Then I made sure I went the way where everything was lit up. I'm out in the open. You're not expecting something like that to happen.
Still reeling from the attack and shaken by the news about her attacker, Betty had to summon all her strength.
I eventually came to the conclusion that I was left to do something. And my something was to bring closure and justice to this situation. He had to be caught. He had to be found.
She had to remember every detail she could about a man she desperately wanted to forget. She told detectives he seemed to be around 5 feet, 10 inches tall.
I can still describe him to this day. He had a gap in the middle of his teeth. His glasses that he wore, they were like wire-rimmed, round glasses. His nose was wide and flat. He had to be in his early 30s.
Detectives were deeply impressed by Betty's courage, and the sketch she helped create was suddenly the best clue police had in not one, but two cases. They were convinced that with the public's help, the sketch would lead to Betty's attacker and Nicole's killer. Detective A.B. Calhoun.
We put it all out in the media with everything from billboards to flyers. This is a break that we needed.
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment.
If you like your true crime, like you like your coffee,
Red Handed is the podcast for you.
It's dark, intense, and might just keep you up all night.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti. And every week on Red Handed, we break down a different fascinating case.
From the most recent US trials everyone is obsessing over, like Brendan Banfield, Karen Reed, and Ellen Greenberg,
to the most unbelievable stories from around the world, there's nothing we love more than digging into every detail of the cases we cover, getting beyond a basic analysis and cutting to the heart of the story.
Red Handed has over 400 episodes ready to binge right now.
Plus, be sure to check out our weekly sister show, Shorthand, where we unpack everything from the Black Death to Area 51.
If you're looking for smart, detailed true crime with personality, check out Red Handed wherever you get your podcasts.
Almost immediately, the description Betty provided advanced a stalled investigation. During a routine patrol of the area where Betty was attacked, detectives walked right into a potential suspect. Detective A.B. Calhoun.
There's a guy that looks just like this composite.
Officers confronted the man, and more red flags were raised.
He did not agree to cooperate with us at all. My thought was there's something about him that's not right.
Not only was he refusing to cooperate, but he seemed familiar to police.
This guy looks remarkably just like the composite. He's lived in the area where the sexual assault occurred. This has to be the guy.
Investigators put together a surveillance team to follow the man, hoping to obtain the DNA evidence they needed to prove it.
He discarded a cigarette butt, and we were able to pick that up.
Would that cigarette butt be the clue that would bring Nicole Smith's killer to justice? Detective Calhoun believed the answer was yes. As he waited for the DNA test results, there was only one thought racing through his mind.
Just wait. It's gonna be him.
But the DNA results were not what they expected.
The DNA was not a match.
The detective was shocked. It was another crushing blow to the investigation.
It was disappointing, to say the least. But at the end of the day, he didn't commit the crime. So you suck it up and you move on.
The suspect's DNA profile was uploaded into the CODIS database, but it too failed to yield a match. Over the next decade, the DNA of dozens of other potential suspects were tested. But the results all led to the same dead end. After years with no results, Betty Brown became convinced the man who attacked her would never face justice.
You never learn how to deal with it. It's trying every day. It's very trying, trying to understand, like, what is he doing? Where is he? How is he able to not be caught? I'm sure he's done it before. You don't just do something like that and stop. I don't know. That's why I went through a lot of anger. I was mad. I was confused. I didn't understand.
The constant letdowns took a heavy toll on Aquanella Smith. But she refused to give up, and her determination was an inspiration for investigators. Crime scene investigator Cheryl McCullum.
She was fearless, relentless. Didn't matter if she was going to make somebody mad. She was going to hold everybody's feet to the fire. She loved her baby.
Investigators never stopped working on the case. In 2015, a new team of detectives started the investigation over from scratch. As they read the case file, they highlighted the details that connected the two crimes.
There was a pattern. He attacked young girls that were alone. These are very soft targets. He's weak. And that's the reason he goes for the victims that he does.
Investigators created an in-depth personality profile of the suspect and updated their composite sketch.
We called in one of our experts, Kelly Lawson, to do an age progression. She made his eyes a little bit older with wrinkles. She said their nose is going to look a little bit bigger. And she added a little gray to his beard, and she made it in color, so that when you put it on TV, you were just captivated by it.
The new sketch brought a second wave of attention to the case. But lead detective Scott DeMeester remained convinced that advances in modern DNA science would be the key to getting justice for Nicole and Betty.
We had the suspect's DNA, so we submitted it to a private laboratory, and with the assistance of a genealogist, we started to build family trees.
The process known as forensic genealogy used public DNA databases to identify distant relatives of the suspect. Police then follow the branches of the family tree in every direction until they reach the killer.
It was very challenging. There was birth certificates, marriage certificates, death certificates. It took almost 3 years. It was a very long process. At times, I was worried that we would never be able to figure it out.
Despite those concerns, the cold case team stayed the course. Over time, they continue to whittle down the list of names.
You take away anybody that doesn't fit in the age bracket. That reduces your suspect pool incredibly. And then you take everybody away that doesn't have a connection to Georgia. It shrinks again. You ain't talking about that many people now.
And that hard work finally paid off.
We were able to identify two sisters that were linked to our suspect. And once we confirmed their relationship, we developed Kelvin Arnold as a person of interest.
The name Kelvin Arnold was nowhere in the case file, but investigators' initial research indicated they might be on the right track. Arnold had been 23 at the time of Nicole's murder and 31 years old on the day Betty was attacked. Detectives dug deeper into their suspect's past, and a photograph of him in the military stopped them in their tracks.
It closely resembled our sketch. I even did some side-by-side comparisons. We look at a picture, look at the sketch, and we're like, wow, that looks just like the person.
As the cold case team carefully moved forward, each step helped convince them that this time they'd get justice. Records showed that Arnold had lived in an apartment that was walking distance from both crime scenes.
We were able to put him in close proximity of both those locations around the time those incidents occurred, and that's when we really started to zero in on him.
But the research also revealed a crushing detail: that Kelvin Arnold had died from liver failure just months before the genealogy test results had linked him to his violent past.
Once we identified him, I learned that he had passed away. No autopsy was performed, no blood or any sort of biological evidence was collected, and that he had subsequently been cremated. There would be no way for us to get a DNA sample, so I had to try to find another way to get a sample of his DNA.
Though Arnold had no felony convictions, Detective DeMeester discovered he had been accused of sexual assault. Although the case had never reached a courtroom, a sample of his DNA had been collected.
We were able to find a piece of evidence that we were able to directly link to him.
The Georgia Bureau of Investigation obtained Arnold's DNA profile from that evidence. It was then compared with the biological evidence from both crimes.
It was actually my son's birthday when the GBI called me to tell me that it was a match.
The detective couldn't wait to share the news.
I was excited. First person I called was Miss Smith to let her know.
For Aquanella Smith, that conversation led to mixed emotions.
He said, "Miss Smith, I got good news for you, and I have some bad news for you." When he said the bad news, I knew he was dead. I screamed. I cried. I threw things.
At that moment, she realized the question that had haunted her for decades would never be answered.
I had one question for him. Why? What did she do to you that you had to take her life? What? Because she fought you back? You wanted control and she wouldn't allow you to have control?
Then Detective DeMeester told her the name of her daughter's killer. She was shocked to learn he had been living in the community for all those years.
I always thought it was just a random person. I didn't think it was somebody that really lived in that area because everybody knew each other.
But Kelvin Arnold had been a stranger.
Once we had a picture of him, I started trying to think back, did I ever see him around? And I didn't. I never saw this guy before.
Learning about her daughter's killer brought out a tidal wave of emotions.
Frustrating. Angry. Most of all. This man just got away scot-free. He took Nicole's life, and he took my life. He killed two people in the same day. The man was cruel. Mean.
But despite that anger, Aquanella also felt a bit relieved.
I was glad to know that this person was off the street, that he wouldn't hurt anybody else.
For Betty Brown, the identification of Kelvin Arnold brought an end to her own incredibly painful journey. When she looked at his picture, she knew immediately they had the right person.
The first picture I saw, I was like, that's him. That's exactly how I remember him. The glasses, even almost down to what he had on. It was like, finally, I can put a face to what I've been replaying over and over in my head. I can really put a face and a name to that person. It was like the missing pieces put together.
But just like Nicole's mother, Betty felt robbed when she learned that Kelvin Arnold was dead.
I'm thinking to myself, like, you got the easy way out. I didn't get my moment to face you, to confront you, to ask why. And then on the other hand, I'm like, about time. We've gotten somewhere. We're here. We made it this far. So it was a mixture of emotions. I was happy, I was sad, I was mad.
Now she hopes that her story will help other survivors.
I just want to live. It's like you just take that first breath. I just want to move forward. Now was the time for me to speak up and hopefully help the next person to speak up and live and move forward so they know that it gets better. It gets better.
Police have no doubt that Kelvin Arnold was the man who attacked Betty and murdered Nicole Smith. In both cases, he had been a coward, hiding in the shadows, waiting for an unsuspecting victim to cross his path. Detectives came up with a theory of what happened on the morning of Nicole's murder.
Nicole was walking to school with her sister, and she realized that she had left something behind at home. She was walking down a well-worn path to her apartment complex and was accosted and sexually assaulted. It appeared to me that she tried to put up a fight, and for whatever reason, the suspect felt like he needed to shoot her.
Although the answers did little to ease her pain, Aquanella Smith is grateful for the outpouring of support. And based on her tragic experience, she has this advice.
Love your kids. Make them safe. Keep them safe. If something happened to your kids, don't ever give up.
With this chapter in her life closed, Aquanella has found a new way to honor her daughter's memory. Every year on Nicole's birthday, she writes her a note and releases balloons.
I buy a birthday card and tell her what I'm feeling, what I'm going through, how much I miss her.
More than two decades later, her pain is still as raw as it was on the day she first heard the gunshots.
The pain is just so severe. I thought after 26 years, the pain would ease. But it doesn't.
Since Kelvin Arnold's DNA was uploaded into CODIS, police haven't found any evidence that he was responsible for other unsolved crimes. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to follow, rate, and review. And if you want more information on today's case, visit facebook.com/paulazanofficial or just click the link in the episode description. I'm Paula Zahn. Please join us again when we're back on the case, the podcast.
If you like your true crime, like you like your coffee,
Red Handed is the podcast for you.
It's dark, intense, and might just keep you up all night.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti. And every week on Red Handed, we break down a different fascinating case.
From the most recent US trials everyone is obsessing over, like Brendan Banfield, Karen Reed, and Ellen Greenberg,
to the most unbelievable stories from around the world, there's nothing we love more than digging into every detail of the cases we cover, getting beyond a basic analysis and cutting to the heart of the story.
Red Handed has over 400 episodes ready to binge right now.
Plus, be sure to check out our weekly sister show, Shorthand, where we unpack everything from the Black Death to Area 51.
If you're looking for smart, detailed true crime with personality, check out Red Handed wherever you get your podcasts.